Okay, well, today we are going to be studying the first part of Luke chapter 6 and picking up the parallel passages in Matthew chapter 12 and Mark chapter 2, going into the first part of Mark chapter 3. So let's begin our study today with prayer. Father, we thank you for giving us the testimony of your servants and help us to understand more about who you are and the great work of your Son. We thank you in his name. Amen.
Now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain lands, and his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands. And some of the Pharisees said to them, "Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath?" But Jesus answering them said, "Have you not even read this? What David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he went into the house of God, took and ate the showbread, and also gave some to those with him, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat." And he said to them, "The Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath." Now it happened on the other Sabbath also that he entered the synagogue and taught, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. So the scribes and Pharisees watched him closely, whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts, and he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Arise and stand." And he arose and stood. Then Jesus said to them, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy?" And when he had looked around at them all, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. But they were filled with rage and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." But he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." Now when he had departed from there, he went into the synagogue, and behold, there was a man who had a withered hand. And they asked him, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" that they might accuse him. Then he said to them, "What man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will they lay hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and plotting against him how they might destroy him. Now it happened when he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and as they went, his disciples began to pluck the heads of grain. And the Pharisees said to him, "Look, why do they do what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" But he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and hungry, he and those with him? How he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest, and ate the showbread, which is not lawful to eat except for the priest, and also gave some to those who were with him? And he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath.' And he entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a withered hand. So they watched him closely, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, 'Step forward.' And he said to them, Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they kept silent. And when he had looked around at them with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts, he said to the man, Stretch out your hand. And he stretched out, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisee went out and immediately plotted with Herodians against him how they might destroy him.
You notice some common things that were the same between all of those passages and some things that were different. You notice some common elements that they all included, that the passage there about passing through the grain fields and the question about what's lawful on the Sabbath, and they included the elements there about the Lord of the Sabbath. There is also in Matthew's account the quotation of Hosea 6. Now, remember last time around when we were finishing out Luke chapter 5, we had seen the companion passage to that in Matthew chapter 9, and that was quoted yet again. So this passage there from Hosea 6, and as we looked at last time, the meat of that passage from Hosea starts in chapter 5, kind of midway through there. That is a very important part of this discussion today, and something that often gets overlooked when these particular passages are often discussed. And, you know, frankly, I've even had the similar interpretation until looking at that passage from Hosea. That made a huge impact to people the first century and centuries following. We'll take a look at that even further. You'll notice that in this passage that we're looking at here, the parallel passage in Matthew chapter 12 includes a couple of elements that are not in the others, and not only the quotation from Hosea, but the passage there about the illustration of the sheep that falls into the pit on the Sabbath. That's not in the other ones. And also, you've got that element there of the eating of the showbread, or the bread of the presence. That's not in the other accounts. And it's quite interesting when we look at those illustrations there, how they really fit into this equation. But I don't know if you can kind of think back to interpretations you might have heard over the years from different teachers and such like that. I know I have heard kind of they fall into basically three categories. For those that may consider that the Torah is quote-unquote obsolete, you'll often hear this interpretation that Yeshua as Lord of the Sabbath or as something greater than the temple, which you get from the Matthew parallel account, that if you go from that position, then you see that Yeshua was teaching through this another example of a end of the era of the Torah with its commands about the Sabbath and the beginning of the era of grace. So kind of moving from one administration to the next. Now, for those who hold to the persisting nature of some key portions of the Torah, the, quote, moral law and the, quote, ceremonial law, they divide them up that way, moral being mainly the Ten Commandments and some other key passages from the Torah still being operational. One interpretation that I've heard quite often from that perspective is that Yeshua was correcting misinterpretations and unwarranted additions to the Torah rather than setting it aside. So the issue in play from that perspective is that the things that he's addressing here are mainly unwarranted additions that were put on there, healing on the Sabbath being one, and some of the, you know, eating as you're going through the grain fields being something else. Or from another perspective, is that for those that consider that the Torah is still in effect, and also that God has delegated to the elders of Israel the binding and loosening of the Torah, in cases of application of it that are warranted, Yeshua then is talking about a higher standard for the Torah. And we'll get to that in a bit. And it actually relates a bit to the Maccabean period, because one of the first places where that was really struggled with a lot was during the Maccabean period. We'll get to that in a moment. Are those kind of some similar interpretations that you've heard in different perspectives of that? I know I've seen that first one in actually some study Bible notes, in particularly a New International Version study Bible has that particular one in it on these particular passages. So what, I guess some questions that we should start with is the question that was posed to Yeshua, is why do you do what is not lawful on the Sabbath? Well, that's a good question. Because one thing that would be kind of good to refresh our memory is starting with a passage from Exodus chapter 31, where this comes into play, because this is a very serious allegation, because if it indeed is the case and can be brought up on charges, it brings with it capital punishment. Because in Exodus 31, starting in verse 14, therefore you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy for you. Everyone who profanes, heard that from the translation there, and it's really kind of interesting, we'll get to that in a moment, that word profane, because it is kind of key to this discussion as well. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death, for whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. Now, one of the things that we get there as far as profaning is halal. Halal. One of the ways that it's commonly used is to pollute, defile, or profane. Profane has become a bit of an archaic word in English, but profane just simply means to make common, to treat as common. And you can see how that application is in there related to Shabbat, is that if you make common or do common things, common meaning the other things you would do the other 6 days of the week, you drag those into the Shabbat, then that becomes a problem. You're making the Shabbat common by how you're treating it. And again, like profaning the name of the Lord, you're treating the name of the Lord as something common that can be just cast about and brought to derision by common people who don't hold it with any sort of significance. So those are common applications for that. Another thing that we get in this particular passage, and it gets to really a key point of how Sabbath observance has been approached over really a couple thousand years at least going forward, is where we have up here Melacha. Melacha. We first see it show up in Genesis chapter 2. Oh, lo and behold, where would that be? In the first place where we talk about seeing about the Sabbath day. And that is one place that we see that show up. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, by the seventh day, God completed his work, his melacha, which he had done. He had asah. The play between asah and asah and bara are used kind of often in Genesis chapter 1 and have kind of an interesting play that we'll get to in a little bit more detail. Completed the work he had done, and he rested on the Sabbath day from all of his work, his malacha, which he had done, asah. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. In it, he rested from all of his malacha, which he had created, bara, and made, asah. So, kind of that connection there, that all of the stuff that you saw happen in Genesis chapter 1 is kind of blended together into this term that's called melacha. We see that brought forward into Exodus chapter 35, another one of these things that shows the gravity of the Sabbath commandment as it's brought forward. Exodus 35, verses 2 and 3, "For 6 days' work, melacha, may be done, but on the seventh day shall be a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does any melacha on it shall be put to death. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day." Now, one of the things that you see right there is one of the, over time, those two passages from Exodus 31 and 35 preface passages that talk about the how you build the temple, or the tabernacle in that case, and the work that went toward doing that. So, the interpretation of what melacha means was extrapolated from a lot of the things that were done to put the tabernacle together. And that's first seen in the Mishnah, which is kind of codified in the first couple hundred of centuries A.D. in, lo and behold, the tractate on Shabbat. And the 39 categories that come out of that are things related to what you would be involved that you saw in Exodus 31 and 35. Now, for us, the ones that are probably the most significant are, you know, he who sows, plows, reaps, winnows. So we'll be kind of looking at that. And one of the last ones that shows up is number 39 in this part of the Mishnah, in section 7 of it. He who transports an object from one domain to another. That shows up in the illustration of the donkey, the sheep, in the pit. Because that is actually discussed in rabbinical literature, those kinds of situations specifically, and relating to this idea of that last category, he who transports an object from one domain to another. So from some other places in the Hebrew Scriptures, like in Exodus 34, you get some further extrapolations of what is meant by melacha. In Exodus 34:21, plowing and harvesting. So we get harvesting again, another category that is relevant to our discussion here in Luke and the companion parts of Matthew and Mark. Other ones from Numbers 15 are gathering firewood, with that example of the guy who was out gathering firewood, and they're asked what to do with them. And the Lord said to come forward with a death sentence for him. The reasons why these things were codified was because this was a death penalty situation. So one of the things that's flippantly brought up today, it's been floating around the internet for a long time and in kind of letter form before that, and it was fax after that, and even showed up on TV in a popular TV show a few years ago, was basically this idea that there's like a long list of things, and one of which relates to Sabbath observance. So it's like, oh, if I see my neighbor washing his car on the Sabbath, do I go over and stone him? Well, you see, I mean, they're right to see that there's some gravity involved in the situation. But number one, the idea of vengeance of mine, you know, obviously it's now out of your jurisdiction. And if you do go forward with it, you suffer the same fate that you were trying to mete out upon the person. So a little bit of biblical ignorance, but it does bring up a fact that that is a very grave sentence that could be levied. So they were not approached with a kind of a light matter. So you had many different categories to try to narrow down what some of these things were. And Jeremiah brings up one of the things that you'll see that shows up in the Gospels in Jeremiah 17, talking about carrying a burden. You'll see that talked about carrying a mat in one of the healings, and those kinds of situations. Another application from Nehemiah 13 is preparing goods for sale and then taking them to market. So that's kind of another and commerce in general, engaging in commerce. So, with all these definitions that were put forward, you can see where a couple or several of these categories actually fit to the situation of the disciples going through the grain fields. And so, the question then comes up, did Yeshua's disciples violate the Torah, number one, and also rulings based upon the Torah? Well,
most of the disciples were fishermen, for one, not agricultural. Mm. Number two, they were not harvesting for profit to sell. They were just plucking things up and rubbing them in the hands and eating them as they were kind of passing through. So they weren't really technically, what I can see, as harvesting. You know, even though they were eating it, it still wasn't for gain or doing work as their normal thing. Now, if they were out fishing and selling the fish on that day, then yes, they would be profaning the Sabbath.
Okay. Any other observations? Well, one of the things that comes forward with it is that unless the Torah makes an exception for something, it's considered to be included. You know, for example, like when it says the Sabbath will be a complete rest, and most of the Sabbaths you can make food on it. There is one where it says specifically not to. So it's one of those things that unless there is an exception for it, it is included in there. Such things as kindling and such. And one of the rulings that did come down through time is that, you know, the plucking and you could say winnowing of the chaff away from the husk, or the husk away from the kernel, is, unfortunately, it is included in there. The reason why we do know that is that Yeshua did not challenge that. Had it been accepted, like cooking on Shabbat, on most Shabbats, then there would be a reason for him to say, well, you err, like he said to the Sadducees, you err because you don't know the scriptures. And you'd say, well, obviously that's not really harvesting. Well, thing was is that they were. Because how do we know that they were, that was included? Was because what examples does he give? The one of David with the bread of the presence. These are, and the one of the priests operating in the tabernacle or the temple, and the one of the animal into the pit or cistern. Those are all technically illegal. So, thus you would say yes and yes. They were guilty. Thus comes then the defenses. And those defenses that come down there. The defenses are quite interesting here because the first defense of David, you know, asking for the and eating the bread from the tabernacle, which was only accessible from the priesthood. For example, that from Leviticus 24, verses 5 through 9, is where it talks about that specifically. And this was, and it goes through the details of how the cakes are made and such. There in verse 8, every Sabbath day he, meaning the priest, shall set it in order before the Lord continually. It is an everlasting covenant for the sons of Israel. It shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place. For it is most holy from the Lord's offerings by fire, his portion forever. So this is not common food, meaning that if it were eaten by anybody else besides Aaron and his sons, being the priesthood, the Kohanim, that would be profaning it, making it common. So, thus, we got a problem with David. Because what did David do? You can see this in 1 Samuel 21. We went through this here recently, Daniel did. Just a little bit of a refresher here. In Daniel, 1 Samuel 21, there's actually a passage in Daniel, we'll get to that in just a moment. In verses 1 through 6, you have this situation with going to Ahimelech, the priest. Now, just to kind of incidentally, some people have thrown rocks at Mark for talking about calling him a high priest and such. But you know, thing was is that the names of who was involved with the priesthood were kind of, in some cases, used a little bit interchangeably for him and his kin, and later became in a role of a high priest. So that's one consideration. But the thing that should be of note here, that the people involved, the priest and David, knew that what they were doing was highly irregular, to even say the least, but is seen there, like in verse 4. In verse 3, you know, therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread, or whatever can be found. The priest answered David and said, there is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women. David answered the priest and said, surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, though it was an ordinary journey. So the priest gave them the consecrated bread, for there was no bread there, but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. Now, one of the rabbinical midrashes on this, the Yalkut Shimoni, makes a good observation here, that what we read from Leviticus is that on each Shabbat, you're supposed to change them out. So one of the thoughts down through time is that not only was he eating the bread, but this was a Shabbat too. So this is a kind of a double situation, which is very, very good that Yeshua brought this up, because it's got the twin connections to what he's trying to get at here. One of the observations that was made long time ago was the speculation that this was a situation why you would go to any great lengths, both on David's side of asking and accepting it, and the priest forgiving it, was there was extreme hunger involved with this. So you've got a situation of need. Now we'll get to that situation of extreme need versus compassion, and the levels of compassion. Does it have to be an extreme need before you offer compassion on Shabbat, or not? Defense number 2 relates to the priests doing their duties in the temple on Shabbat. Now, as you remember hearing in the Torah, there was the sacrifices, the offerings that were offered on Shabbat. And, of course, for that, there's the slaughtering of animals, there's the keeping the altar and the menorah lit to deal with those, the igniting the incense. And as with the bread, if you're going to change out the bread, there has to be bread. And the priest, they're mentioning hot bread, and some have concluded that, you know, part of that involves the priesthood baking the bread on Shabbat to change it out for the bread of the presence. Now, one of the applications that came down through time for this principle that Yeshua is really appealing to, it's called later in rabbinical literature, in Berachot Yoma, in the Talmud and in the Mishnah, is the Perchuach Nafesh, or the preservation of life. And it comes from Leviticus 18:5, is where they get this from. Now, just reading verses 4 and 5 from Leviticus 18, this is in kind of the context of getting ready to enter the land. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes to live in accord with them. I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my statutes and my judgments, by which a man shall live if he does them. I am the Lord. And that one about live, they really zeroed in on it. It's brought up again and again with this concept of Perkuach Nefesh, is a man may live if he does them. May live. That Chaya is the word that's used there. Because earlier in that passage, it's to live in accordance with them. It's really to walk in accordance with them. And if you walk in accordance with what God's instructions are, then you have hayat, you have life. So in that came the idea down is that a principle that's illustrated in one passage of the Talmud is that positive, if you have two commands in the Torah, one is positive, one leads to chaya, life, and the other one is a prohibition, that the one leading to chaya takes precedence over the prohibition. Now that comes into play here because that is the heart of these defenses that Yeshua is bringing forward. And the reason why Hosea 6 keeps getting quoted over and over and over again. This principle kind of came down later throughout during the Roman persecution of the Jews, but also it shows up in when you read the Maccabees as well. Basically, if a man is commanded, break the commandment and you will not suffer death. He may transgress and not suffer death, excepting idolatry, sexual immorality, and murder. So in idolatry, there's the first three commandments, sexual immorality and murder being part of the final five and final six. And coveting, you could maybe lump that in with idolatry, maybe tangentially, but some of the others then come into play. And that's been a challenge down through time because people have looked at commands like honor your father and your mother. Okay, well, what if your father is a monster and is beating your mother and beating the kids and this and that and the other? Do you still honor them? Well, the principle of the preservation of life, thus the honoring of the father has to be set aside to promote life. In which case, you're actually bringing him greater honor by putting a stop to that behavior. Hopefully, he pulls back from it. But in the least case, he's able to stop from doing it. And again, that kind of goes to the heart of the bearing false witness. Now, honesty is always the best policy because, number one, you don't have to remember all of the fibs and big whoppers that you've told. But also, it's hard to get to that level of, you know, when God's saying, you know, we long to be, you know, communing face to face. You really break that down with other people when you lie and misrepresent things to them, whether it be small or whether it be big. But in the case of where honesty is used by those intent on evil as a tool, then do you promote chaya? Or do you promote evil? And those cases being Rahab with the spies, the people who were intent on getting the correct information about where the spies were in Jericho, that would have brought death to the spies on a mission that God was taking them toward. And, of course, one that's always brought up is the issue related to if someone is being, you know, secreted away. Often the example of hiding Jews during the Holocaust is brought up as an example. And the Gestapo is asking, you know, do you have Jews here? What do you do about it? Is honesty then made a tool of evil? Or is chaya promoted? So it's one of those things because it really comes to the heart of this because this is not something that you approach upon lightly, because if you do lie to the Gestapo, so for example, because that's the most egregious form example of this, if you do lie, you are breaking the commandment. You can't even get away from that. You are breaking the commandment. But then, is it justified? Now, again, that's not you don't go about that lightly. Just like with Shabbat, the priesthood, they are breaking the Shabbat. David was breaking the Shabbat. The disciples were breaking the Shabbat. Now, thus, what is the key issue going forward? And that's why Hosea keeps coming up again and again and again. So going forward with this is this phrase that's you see in Matthew 12, verse 6, when we were reading through there. Matthew 12, verse 6. Continuing on with this illustration right after Yeshua gives the illustration of David eating the bread of the presence when he was hungry, Yeshua says there, starting in verse 5, "Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here." Now, one of the ways that this is often interpreted is that, what is that something? And that's something that I was saying as well. One of the things to think about here is we see that in a companion passage. It also applies into that thing of Lord of the Sabbath. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Now, one of the things I was bringing up, Daniel, passage from Daniel, is that the Son of Man shows up as a messianic, I guess you would call it another name, a nickname for the Messiah is Son of Man. However, it is often used throughout the prophets and rabbinical literature to mean man in general. So what we then have is, with the interpretation that Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath and something greater than the temple is here, being Yeshua himself, thus you have an argument saying that because Yeshua is greater than the temple, and because Yeshua is the Lord of the Sabbath, thus he's doing away with the Sabbath and doing away with the temple, because he's supreme over both of them. That's how it is commonly interpreted. However, when we look at what the illustrations that Yeshua is giving from the scriptures, both the illustration of eating the bread of the presence and also this illustration that we had seen earlier of the priest serving in the temple, and also the illustration of the animal that's down in the pit, we see the common thread in there is what? Hosea 6:6. I desire compassion, I desire chesed, and not sacrifice. Now, didn't God command sacrifice? Yes, he did. But what was he looking for? What is the supreme thing? So one of the things that we see in both of these illustrations here is, for example, that human need supersedes the temple. So you could say, need greater than temple. Then we see in the other illustration, temple is greater than the Shabbat. And therefore, the human need is greater than the Shabbat. That's if you take that, because the way that it's commonly interpreted is, for example, the idea of something greater than the temple being Yeshua, thus you would have the need is greater than the temple is greater than the Shabbat, therefore the Messiah is greater than the Shabbat. And then you could also say greater than the temple there as well. But just to kind of illustrate this, if any of you have followed logic in any sort, basically, if A is greater than B and B is greater than C, then A, which is the need, is greater than C. That just has to be the case, because if all of these are true, then that has to be true. But with the interpretation that, something greater than the temple is here being Yeshua, Lord of the Sabbath and such, it changes that to then D is greater than C. Well, that doesn't work logically. Logic doesn't work like that, because you now introduce something that you haven't even illustrated yet. So you can't have that kind of a situation, Because that's not following the whole train of where Yeshua is going with all these illustrations. You've got three illustrations that are going to the point of compassion. Compassion, compassion, compassion. What is the thrust of the prophets? Even with that quote from Hosea, is that the heart, compassion comes out of heart. A heart aligned with God has to align you with God and everything God says. If you're going through the motions, like Isaiah 58 is a good example, where it talks about Shabbat and fasting together in the same one. If you go through the motions of fasting and Shabbat, but you're ignoring what Yeshua calls the weightier matters of the law, then you're missing the entire point of it all, both the Torah, the writings, and the prophets, and Yeshua. So it's one of those great cases of when people make this illustration, well, it's an end of the era of law and the beginning of the era of mercy. You're missing the whole thrust of the scriptures where it's saying that mercy has to guide your life with God. When God gives you instructions, compassion has to be a part of that. It absolutely has to be a part of that. It's not in place of it, but it has to be part of that. And when you see these things, these commands that are extremely great, you know, when there is a situation where compassion has to take precedence over Shabbat, for example, in this case, you have to realize that it is breaking the Shabbat. I mean, you can't pussyfoot around that situation at all. It is breaking the Shabbat. However, it's not something that you do flippantly. In fact, there's an old one manuscript of Mark inserts a phrase in there that's found only in one manuscript, so it's considered to be an injection, meaning that it likely came from that time period. It's a very old manuscript, but not thought to be original. But it kind of gets to the point. You can understand why some scribe decided to throw it in, which is basically it's attributed to Yeshua and says that if you understand what you're doing and you break the Sabbath, you're not guilty. If you don't understand what you're doing and you break the Sabbath, you're guilty. The idea being that realize that if you're going against God's instructions, you're on thin ice. If compassion is guiding you, you got to need to have the heart of God if you're going to be going out on that line. Because you read what the prophets were instructed to do, especially, oh, good grief, like Ezekiel. My goodness, that poor guy went through a lot of stuff. Jeremiah as well. And they were asked to do some things that were just, ugh, horrifically bad. But one of the things that they were bringing forward was an important message that really jar the people back into the line with God. So it's one of those things that, yes, compassion has to guide what you do, but it also has to be in line with where God is going. So it's really one of those really interesting cases that where legalism really falls into huge trouble. Because, you know, legalism, strictly speaking, is law without mercy. But that is not the testimony of God. And to say it as such really is blasphemy, because you're misrepresenting God completely. Because you can't look at the Torah, Leviticus 16, with the Day of Atonement and such, and not see that ultimate justice and ultimate mercy are mixed together. Absolutely mixed together. Well, we have to wrap things up for today. Let's see.
Like you said, there's such a fine line between legalism and you have compassion, but also the Sabbath is supposed to be a joy. So here's an argument, you know, within the Messianic community. You wake up on Sabbath morning, you know, you're not supposed to cook. That means chopping vegetables. You should prepare the meal. So you want to have a cup of coffee. Well, if you turn on your gas stove, some people would say, well, you're kindling a fire. You can't do that. Or if you just use the drip system, you're making a cup of coffee, but you're still working.
Or you turn on your car.
You know, I mean, there's such a fine line, and the Sabbath is supposed to be a delight and a joy. So is it right or wrong to have a cup of coffee? Should you not use your gas stove? Well, you're using your heater to heat your house, which is a flame. You know, it gets so the dynamics get so tricky, and there's this argument within the, you know, Messianic community on what's right, what's wrong, you know, where is it going to legalism? So it's a tough call sometimes.
Yeah, so basically you start with the instructions that God gives you, and to Him you're ultimately responsible. So if you decide to do one way or the other, follow one person's ruling or another, you have to really realize, you know, where is your connection with God going? Are you starting with what He said and moving forward and looking out into the world and seeing the need to the point where, you know, we didn't really get a chance to talk with about further, but the thing about the healing. Now, there was a lot of discussion over the centuries about healing, even miraculous healing, which miraculous healing kind of falls into God's territory as to whether that's, you know, something on Shabbat, not on Shabbat. We see examples that we've already read so far in Luke where people were coming to Him after Shabbat for healing. So recognizing, yeah, the power of God is at work, but they were coming after Shabbat because, again, there was that conflict going on. Yes, compassion, but if you can do it the other 6 days of the week, don't do it then. You know, defer it to some other time. However, it's one of those points where God was seeing the need at that point in time and deciding to act. And He was acting for a specific reason. Bringing God the glory of where is the true thrust of God's law in God's heart. Is it only in law? Or is it law as an example of a principle that also includes compassion? They're all wrapped justice and mercy and faith, which is trust, all wrapped together and being the true testimony of who God is versus just justice only. So it's one of those things where you build this relationship with God over time, and God has to guide that expression of compassion. And if there is no compassion in your approach to God, then that's also a sign that there is also a kind of a challenge and a need to really build a bridge closer to who God is. So in that sense, you know, do you make the food? Do you not make the food? This and that. Well, who is it really responsible to? Who is your judge? Is it some other guy or is it God? If you're just trying to appease the other guy, you know, you're not pulling a fast one on God at all. So it's who are you ultimately responsible to? And that is why this is such a key issue of trying to get to the heart of who God is and a true representation of who God is. Because one of the main roles that you see not only in the prophets but also the apostles talk about a lot is show us who God is. And Yeshua is here as a representation of who God is. Justice and mercy and trust, all wrapped together. Is it an easy thing? No, it is an easy thing. But when it's one of those things where you talk about the Spirit of God really moving not only just to believe or understand, but also to be able to act and see. Not only see people the way God sees them, as, you know, having the Spirit of God and being made in His likeness, but also being able to respond when compassion calls for it. One of the great, we talked about it last time around with the parable of the Good Samaritan. That was an example. You know, the priest and the scribe were right that helping this guy who may be dead would completely defile them, whether it was during a festival or not. It must have been during a festival because they were pretty excited about it. It would have disqualified them from acting or participating in the service of the tabernacle or even participating in the festival itself. But at that moment, what was under demand? It was compassion. So it's one of those things, there's no easy answer for it, because it's something that God has to do over a lifetime with us in building us into more of like who He is and how He sees things. So that's why, that, like you mentioned, the fine line between legalism and having, you know, seeing a true picture of who God is, it's a very fine line, because you can teeter onto one side or the other side. Just like we were talking about earlier, you can easily... That's why Paul was assailed from both sides, you know, as a libertine, someone who just, you know, free will, free grace, everything, and to those who thought he was just too strict. And that is why it's a really fine line to go with, and why really only God's wisdom. That's why, you know, the Apostle Yaakov said, if any of you lacks wisdom, ask God. Don't be tossed back and forth like a ship on the waves and such. If you don't understand the way you should act or what God means by justice and mercy, ask Him, and He will give you the wisdom. And that's, well, truly, when you talk about wisdom, it's being able to take the stuff in your head and actually do something with it. Because otherwise, yeah, there's plenty of smart people that are completely foolish. Are there any final thoughts? We have to kind of wrap things up here. All right, well, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank You so much for giving us the testimony of all Your servants down through time. Father, help us to get a clearer picture of who You are and what You want us to do in the world around us. Help us to be Your representatives in the world around us and give other people a true representation of who You are. Father, we thank You for all these things and giving us the testimony, the clearest testimony of who You are through Your Son Yeshua. Amen.